A stark warning from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We could see a dramatic rise in COVID cases.
And if so, we'll be looking at many more deaths and the need for lockdowns.
I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And I'm Scott Simon, and this is Up First from NPR News.
Public health experts are watching coronavirus infection numbers go up in some states and say we are still in the thick of this pandemic. Here's Ashish Jha, professor of global health.
We really never quite finished the first wave, and it doesn't look like we are going to anytime soon.
And President Trump trying to walk a line between supporting police and pressure to ban their use of chokeholds.
While in the United Kingdom, protests intensify over racial inequality, mirroring what we're seeing here in the U.S.
So stay with us for the news you need to start your weekend.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp, online counseling by licensed professional counselors specializing in isolation, depression, stress, and anxiety. Visit betterhelp.com/upfirst to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Coronavirus infections are on the rise in a number of states. Nationwide, around 800 people are still dying each day.
And on Friday, the CDC warned that if cases begin to, quote, go up dramatically, we may need to return to stricter mitigation measures.
NPR's global health correspondent, Nurit Eisenman, joins us. Nurit, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
Where are the numbers going up? What are hot spots now?
So California, Florida, Texas, now reporting their largest daily new infections to date. Also worrisome, Arizona. 3 weeks ago, it was seeing less than 400 new cases a day. Now the daily average is more than 1,200. In a similar boat, Utah, South Carolina. But even in states where the numbers don't look so bad, there's a troubling trend. And to talk about it, I want to get just a bit technical.
That's fine. We need to hear it, please.
Okay, so a key indicator is what's called the reproduction number, or the R. It tells you, for every person who's infected, how many people will they go on to infect? Now, if it's above one, the virus spreads exponentially. For instance, it's estimated that before the U.S. stay-at-home orders, the reproduction number was above two. So think about it, Scott. Let's say you're infected with the virus, then you would go on to infect two others, who go on to infect four, who infect eight, 16. That upward spiral happens fast. So the key is to push that reproduction number below one. And we did that during the stay-at-home period, but we only barely pushed the reproduction number below one. And that means that while the infections weren't spiraling up, we reached almost a steady state, this kind of drip, drip of new infections and new deaths each day. Ashish Jha is the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. He says if this status quo continues,
we're going to continue seeing 25 to 30,000 additional deaths a month. So this is really quite bad. And the level of virus and the level of disease burden in our country is very, very large.
And then on top of that, with the reopenings, in two-thirds of states, the reproduction number has already crept up past one again.
Is this the second wave that people were worrying about?
Right. The term second wave can be misleading because, of course, we never actually ended the first wave. We've just been chugging along. But that said, there is growing evidence that come autumn, we will move from this kind of steady state situation to a steep rise in cases.
And that sounds alarming. Tell us what we need to know.
Well, so on Thursday, a prominent forecaster from the University of Washington, Chris Murray, said that when his team analyzed the curve of COVID-19 cases so far, they find that it's followed a seasonal pattern that's very similar to the seasonal pattern for pneumonia in the U.S., namely that in the warmer months, pneumonia cases go down.
If it is seasonal, why doesn't it basically disappear in the summer?
Right. So when there's a totally new virus like this one, we have no immunity. It rips through us. So even if the warmer months slow down the virus's ability to spread, there's still going to be so many of us who are ripe for infection that the seasonal effect will be small. But come autumn, Murray says the seasonal effect really could make a difference with case counts. Let's take a listen.
We start to see a powerful increase starting in early September. And these numbers will intensify through February.
So he says seasonality will be a very big driver of the second wave.
NPR's Nurit Eisenman, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Congressional Democrats have unveiled legislation to ban the use of chokeholds by police, one of many reforms being sought after the killing of George Floyd. Now, Republicans are taking a look, but President Trump is skeptical.
And you get somebody in a chokehold, and what are you going to do now? Let go and say, oh, let's start all over again. I'm not allowed to have you in a chokehold.
So, question here, does that mean the president has his own ideas for reform? We've got NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez to talk about that. Good morning.
Good morning, Lulu.
So what does the president support when it comes to policing reforms?
Well, he supports the police, full stop. He rejects any assertions that there is systematic racism. Instead, he blames bad apples. Mm-hmm. I actually traveled with him to Dallas this week. He said the White House will provide recommendations on standards for the use of force. In that Fox interview that you played, he said that he doesn't like the use of chokeholds, but he stopped short of supporting a ban. Here's more.
With that being said, it would be, I think, a very good thing that, generally speaking, it should be ended.
You know, we'll hear from Republicans probably this week about what they support. Senator Tim Scott is leading that effort in the Senate, and Jim Jordan in the House. And we'll see if the White House releases the executive order with details of what the president can support.
Okay, the president, meanwhile, is traveling today to West Point. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, he'll be speaking at the U.S. Military Academy graduation. The graduating cadets are returning for the ceremony after being sent home early when the virus struck. The White House says the president is there to honor the cadets, but we'll see if he sticks to the tradition or veers off into the political sphere, as he sometimes does. Will he address the policing and racial tensions that have consumed the White House? You know, it's caused tensions with military leadership. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, said this week it was a mistake to accompany Trump for a photo op after protesters were forced out of Lafayette Square. And Trump quashed any idea of renaming Army bases that honor Confederate officers. And that's after Defense Secretary Esper appeared open to the idea.
Okay, Franco, he is also going to take another trip next week to Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he'll hold his first rally since March. He is restarting rallies despite the pandemic.
Right. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, there's been a new spike of COVID-19 cases that have raised concerns, and he's getting back on the campaign trail. The president has been pushing to get back on the trail, but his campaign clearly knows there are risks. And they are making sure those who attend the Tulsa rally agree not to sue the campaign if they contract coronavirus. The location is also very controversial. Symbolism matters when a president travels, but the symbolism here is quite relevant because Tulsa is the location of one of the worst massacres of African Americans in U.S. history.
And especially at this time when there's so much tension over police brutality and the treatment of African Americans and racism. And he had scheduled to hold this rally on June 19th, Juneteenth. But it looks like those plans changed overnight.
Yeah, that's right. That's a day that marks the end of slavery in America. Some African American leaders saw that as insulting and called for him to change the date. And late last night, he tweeted that to honor those requests, he had moved the rally to the following day.
NPR White House correspondent Frank Ordonez, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And for the latest from the White House and the campaign, you can check out the NPR Politics podcast.
So protests continue today in the United Kingdom, targeting racism and its legacy.
And just as it has here, the conflict has expanded to involve statues. The question, which should stay, which should go?
Frank Langfitt is NPR's London correspondent, and he joins us now to talk about that. Hi, Frank.
Hey, good morning, Lulu.
So we've been watching what's happening here with Confederate statues and monuments. A different history over there in the UK, but a similar debate. What historical figures are we talking about?
Well, it's strikingly similar as an American correspondent covering the UK. It started really on Sunday. Protesters tore down a statue of a man named Edward Colston, who was a philanthropist, but also was involved in the slave trade in Bristol, the English city of Bristol. Now there's this map, Lulu, online called Topple the Racists. It's a crowdsourced map, and there are other sites that people are looking at. Nelson's Column over Trafalgar Square.
Wow.
Statue of Robert. I know.
That's a central statue there in London.
Yeah, I mean, that is, everybody who comes to London sees that. It's at the center of Trafalgar Square. There's a statue of Robert Baden Powell. He was the founder of the Scouts, what we know in the States, of course, as the Boy Scouts. Yesterday, somebody vandalized the signs for Penny Lane in Liverpool of Beatles fame, claiming that it was connected to a slaver named Penny. People in Liverpool say that's not true, and we're cleaning it up this morning.
Huh. How does the public feel about this from what you can tell?
You know, it's divisive. It depends on age, politics, and to some degree, race. You have a lot of young progressives in places like London who think the country needs to confront its colonial past, how much money was made off of slavery and lead to the removal of these statues. Then you have a lot of patriotic white Britons who are angry and upset. Last weekend, during the protests, somebody sprayed on Churchill's statue, which is right across from Big Ben, as you know, saying he was a racist. Now, one of my neighbors planned to go down this weekend actually to defend the statue during the protest. His name is Andy Musket. I was talking to him yesterday, and this is what he said.
I would be quite willing to stand in front of that statue and protect him, because that's what he means to us. That's what he means to this country. They wouldn't have this speech. If we'd been taken over by the Germans, these marches wouldn't be happening.
It reminds us so much of the divisions that have already played out in the United Kingdom over Brexit and other things. This seems to be exacerbating them yet again. What has been the reaction from authorities there, either local or in London?
Yeah, what they're trying to do, Lulu, is protect the statues and prevent violence. So they took the Churchill statue and they boarded it up. It now has a box on top of it, so you can't see it anymore. Now, right now, there are hundreds of counter-demonstrators surrounding that box, singing God Save the Queen, and they're flying the Union Jack. And the fear today is that there's going to be a clash with Black Lives Matter protesters. Now, the London group for BLM says don't participate in the protest today. It's not worth it. The mayor says that some of the far right are coming down to protest and to basically set a trap for Black Lives Matter protesters. And cops are saying whatever happens, the protests have to finish by 5 p.m. today, because that's usually, Lulu, when the violence kicks off here.
That's incredibly tense.
Yeah.
You mentioned protesters have also focused on the founder of the Scouts. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the Robert Baden Powell, he has a statue in the town of Poole, which is on the English Channel. Critics say he was a homophobe and a supporter of Hitler. The statue did show up on this list, this map to topple the racists. And so scouts were actually sleeping out overnight to protect it. And finally, the local government there has covered it in wood and built a box around it to protect it.
So I'm curious, how are you thinking about this as someone who studies the UK?
Well, I mean, I was talking to a history professor and other people, and this really is a battle over identity and history in the form of these statues. And of course, it's about just what you were saying, slavery, empire, the colonial past. And the protesters, I think, want to change the historical landscape to fit more with the progressive values of, say, London today. Many white Britons are unsettled because they're seeing icons under attack. And as this historian was telling me, you know, when statues get torn down, we associate that more with regime change, which is really jarring for people.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Thank you so much.
Great to talk, Lulu.
And that's Up First for Saturday, June 13th, 2020. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro. Up First is back Monday with news you need to start your week.
You can follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter. And keep an eye on this feed for the occasional special episode.
And for everything else you need to stay informed, as well as interviews and reviews, and also stuff that's just interesting and entertaining.
Listen to us on the radio on Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday mornings.
Find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
You may have noticed something at all these protests over police violence. There are a lot more white people there than you'd expect. But how long will that last?
This awakening among white American voters, how far are they really willing to go beyond dethroning Trump?
Adam Serwer on Race and Lessons from History. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from NYU Stern's Executive MBA program, now available in downtown Washington, D.C. Classes are conveniently held one weekend a month. Visit stern.nyu.edu/EMBA/DC.